Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour of our show, we will be talking about Nigeria. Nigeria is one of the world's biggest oil producers. It is also the most populous country in Africa. In spite of the country's great natural wealth, most Nigerians live in poverty. In particular, the people who live in the country's oil-producing region have complained that their land has become severely polluted as a result of oil production, and that they have gotten almost nothing in exchange. In this hour, we'll be trying to talk a bit about the people and the politics of Nigeria, and our guest is Michael Watts. He is professor of geography at the University of California at Berkeley, and among other things, has been following politics in Nigeria for some time now. He's particularly interested in the political economy and political ecology of oil as it applies to Nigeria. He is the former director of the Institute of International Studies there at Berkeley and is joining us by telephone. We'll talk a little bit this morning about the connections between oil, poverty, and violence in this most populous nation, Africa's most populous nation. And of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in, and we certainly welcome the calls, the only thing we ask is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving, get in as many different callers as possible. But callers are certainly welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. So that would mean if it would be a long-distance call for you and you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, even people listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, may use that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Watts, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Whenever we do a show like this, I always feel that at the very beginning, a little bit of basic background is necessary. So if I ask you this, and admittedly, I'm sure that one could talk for a long time about Nigeria and its history and its politics and where we are now. Let me, though, ask the question, what is the most important thing or the most important things, at least to start out, for people to know about Nigeria?
There are a couple of things I think we could flag. Firstly, as you mentioned at the beginning, David, Nigeria is an enormous country, a population of 150 million or thereabouts. It's economically and politically important on the continent. It's been a central player in the various military operations of the continent and through the African Union. So it's sort of strategically significant in that sense. Secondly, of course, it's a major oil producer. It's the ninth largest oil producer in the world. It's a major supplier of the U.S. market. And it's part of what has now emerged in the last 10 years or so, the so-called Gulf of Guinea, as a major oil-producing region in Africa. And last but not least, Nigeria is sort of geostrategically, you might say, significant in the following sense. It's a member of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. In fact, its petroleum minister is currently the head of OPEC. So it has, it throws its weight about, so to say. It's a very rambunctious country, you might say. It takes its role very seriously in Africa and outside. So you put all of those three things together, I think you can begin to realize that both within the continent itself and outside, it's of enormous importance, politically and economically. And last but not least, its political stability, it seems to me, is of great interest, not only to the United States, but to the world, because a radical destabilization of the country, and we're approaching some elections next month, would have big spillover effects, knock-on effects, for the stability of the entire region.
Let me ask you another question, and again, this is obviously a big question. Given the fact that Nigeria has very significant resources of oil and has been producing oil since the 1960s, that is certainly a fact. It is also true that not only most Nigerians are quite poor, the people who live in the oil-producing region in the Niger Delta are the poorest of of all of the people in Nigeria. Why is it that, given this great resource, that the vast majority of Nigerians have benefited not at all from it?
Well, let me again, if I can, before I answer that, just maybe give a little bit of background for your listeners. It's been estimated that since oil became commercially significant in the 60s, perhaps something like between $400 and $500 billion U.S. dollars of petrodollars have flowed into the Nigerian exchequer. Bear in mind that, as in many parts of the third world at least, most oil operations consist of a relationship between a local national oil company, in this case the Nigerian National Petroleum Company, and one or more of the oil majors, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Shell, whatever they may be. And that joint venture or that contractual relationship means that for every barrel of oil produced, a large proportion of it, perhaps two-thirds or more, depending on price and other arrangements, contractual arrangements, flow directly into the coffers of government. So what this means then is that for oil producers like Nigeria, the oil wealth flows directly into government, and since 1960s, there have been a lot of it, $400 to $500 billion have flown in, have, as it were, rushed into the government coffers. Now you say, what's happened with that oil money? An extraordinary amount of wealth, actually, in practice. Well, here are a couple of statistics to sort of give one a sense of what has happened to that oil wealth. Firstly, according to the World Bank, about 80% of that oil wealth in any one year is accrued by 1% of the population. Secondly, over the period, again, the World Bank says that between 1970 and 2000, the proportion of Nigerians living on a dollar a day has increased from about 36 to 70%. So that means that about 80 to 90 million Nigerians currently living on a dollar a day, against a backdrop over that 30-year period of this huge influx of oil money. Over the same period, it's also estimated that the per capita income and the life expectancy fell. Let me repeat that. In the context of that huge influx of oil money, per capita income and life expectancy actually fell. So what that translates into then, and the International Monetary Fund put it very powerfully a few years ago when they said that in their view, the discovery and exploration and growth of oil in Nigeria has not added significantly to the standard of living of Nigerians. Now, this picture that I've just painted is an astonishing picture, actually. I mean, it's a massive failure of political leadership, of development in all of its aspects. And so Nigerians as a whole, then, have not benefited from this enormous amount of oil wealth. And secondly, as you rightly said, the oil-producing region itself in the southeast of the country, nine states within the 36-state federation of Nigeria, have benefited in spite of the fact that the oil is located there and they suffer and have suffered all of the environmental costs of a major oil industry in the region. They have benefited least of all. And again, I don't want to sort of bore your listeners with statistics, but average life expectancy and access to public health and other educational facilities and services are lower in the oil-producing region than on average in the country as a whole. So that's a very bleak accounting of what oil wealth has meant for Nigeria. Some people have even referred to oil as a type of curse, a resource curse. But the reality is that there's been absolutely no transformation of this oil wealth into self-sustaining growth in the country that has had a demonstrable impact on standards of living and on human development.
And then just now to get us where we are right now and to talk about the possibility for conflict and instability, something that is, it's not exactly new, but it seems that it's kind of a thing that is attaining some critical mass is that we have armed movements have organized, in a sense, around these resources, or at least in some of the places where the resources are located.
Right.
And as a result, that it has an effect on oil supply, oil revenue, and that's sort of a short-term thing that has long-term implications. And then overall, it creates this atmosphere for very serious political instability that indeed could have very long-term consequences in terms of the country's ability to produce and export oil.
Absolutely. Well, again, let's just throw out a couple of statistics. As we speak, something like 700,000 to 800,000 barrels per day in Nigeria are shut in. Shut in is the technical term the oil industry uses for lost production. And that lost production is entirely a result of the proliferation of various types of increasingly militant activities by some groups that we'll perhaps talk about later on in the show, who have essentially compromised production by sabotage, by detonating pipelines, by occupying various types of oil installations. Now, what does that 700,000 or 800,000 barrels mean? It means that perhaps something close to one-third of national output is currently compromised. So that's in the context, of course, of a global oil market right now that is particularly tight, in the context of the Bush administration in particular, increasingly relying on African and especially Nigeria as a key producer for its own domestic consumption. Something like 10% of U.S. oil imports come from Nigeria. In the context, then, of all of that, this shut-in of this proportion of Nigerian oil production as a result of conflict and militancy represents an enormous set of problems, not only, of course, for the functioning of oil markets, but for the political stability of Nigeria itself. So, again, this, in a sense, in my own view, I guess I've come to see the Niger Delta, the oil-producing region, currently as almost ungovernable. There has been a massive proliferation of various types of militant groups who are increasingly now, against that backdrop that I described of their economic and political marginalization from this oil wealth, who have become particularly, I would say, since the mid to late 1990s, increasingly angry. You have a whole generation of youth, as they're called, in the Niger Delta, who are extremely angry and bitter about their, in a sense, their marginalization from any benefits of oil and from the lack of a functioning democracy at the local level. And they have increasingly taken up arms and are now large in number. There are a number of different types of militant groups, which we can talk about. They're exceedingly well armed, and they're able to finance their insurgency. So I think what we have in the oil-producing delta right now is something very close to an insurgency.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michael Watts, he is professor of geography at University of California, Berkeley, has been following politics in Nigeria for a long time. And that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions, again, I would say to people who are listening, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Nigeria was a British colony, became independent in 1960, and then probably for most of its history since independence was ruled by the military. And that really only changed significantly in 1999 when Olusegun Obasanjo, who is the president now, became president. And he has served, I believe, two terms, but he is going to be stepping down. There are supposed to be elections this year. Why isn't it not the case? I mean, one could understand that perhaps the country's oil, during the time of military dictatorship, that the country's oil wealth would have been siphoned off into the hands of a few people. Why is it, though, that during this now more recent period where we had a democratically elected government, if that indeed is the case, why is it that the government led by President Obasanjo hasn't done better in terms of addressing the particular concerns of the people who live in the Niger Delta, and also this larger issue of having some more equitable distribution of the wealth that comes from the country's natural resources?
Well, your question, of course, raises the issue of what on earth has happened to these vast quantities of oil money. And the brief answer, and it's been put by the head of the World Bank quite clearly, Paul Wolfowitz, who is someone I wouldn't ordinarily want to quote, but he, and he's right on this count, has said that over the last 40 years, perhaps simply $300 billion have been, as he put it, either wasted or disappeared, where it disappeared is simply a euphemism for sort of massive and endemic corruption, which I think has grown over time. And as you rightly said, well, perhaps during the military period, and bear in mind, since 1960, the vast majority of Nigerian political history has been under military rule, in some cases, as in the 1990s, exceptionally violent military rule under the Abacha government, that perhaps under those circumstances one would expect, in a sense then, or that these sort of authoritarian, anti-democratic governments would be in a position to actually raid, as it were, the federal exchequer, the oil revenues that flow directly into the oil state. And indeed, they did do this. But the question that you pose then is, well, since 1999, we've had a so-called democratic dispensation. And why haven't things gotten better? And in fact, in some respects, some people actually think they have deteriorated. In 2002, an Economic Crimes Commission was set up with the specific purpose of looking into corruption. And the head of that commission in 2002, by his own estimation, said that something like 70% of the oil revenues were simply wasted or stolen. So this now is during a democratic dispensation, so-called. So how do we begin to explain that? Well, I think the backdrop for this, we have to look very much at the political nature of Nigeria itself. It's a large country, as I've said, but it's also multi-ethnic. It's difficult to sort of calculate how many ethnic groups there might be in the country, but some people believe that it's between 250 and 300. It's multi-ethnic. It's multi-religious. Overall, it's a Muslim state, but there are strong religious differences between the north and south of the country. And the history, politically, of Nigeria has been that so-called ethnic majorities that account for perhaps two-thirds of the population in the north, the Hausa, Fulani in the southwest, the Yoruba and the Igbo in the southeast, have dominated this sort of rickety political structure. So to understand, then, why in the democratic period, as it were, this corruption has continued and perhaps even deepened, you have to understand the very competitive nature of ethnic politics and, to a certain extent, religious politics in Nigeria, and how, then, politics and some degree of political stability, even in the democratic period, has consisted of the, as it were, the distribution of these oil monies, which are now centrally controlled and allocated by government to key political and often, therefore, ethnic constituencies in order to, as it were, purchase a degree of political stability or consent. It's not been terribly successful since 1999 because, in a sense, we've had a proliferation of all manner of conflict, not least in the Niger Delta. So that's a long and complicated answer to your question, but it seems to me then the issue is that the corruption and the extent to which there has been this, in a way, what we might call a type of decentralization of corruption. That, I think, is what's happened since 1999. In the military period, a lot of that corruption of oil monies occurred at the federal level. What we've seen then is the decentralization of that and the growth of very powerful governors who preside over their states. There are 36 of them. And this has produced then a decentralization of corruption at every level of government right down to the local level. So the local level, the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission that I referred to, for example, the director recently referred to local government as nothing more than gangsterism and organized crime. That's how he described it. So in a sense, then, the great paradox is that the democratic dispensation, I don't think we have, we could talk a little more about the elections in 1999 and 2003, but and how corrupt they were, especially in 2003, and particularly in the Niger Delta. But it seems to me that, nonetheless, overall, what we've seen in the name of a functioning democratic turn since 1999 has been these two things happening, the decentralization of corruption and what we might call the democratization of violence. More and more people have access to arms and are taking up their grievances, which are many and multiple. How could they not be, in virtue of the fact that so much of this oil wealth has been corrupted and wasted, are now increasingly then not going to the ballot box, but taking up arms?
Well, let's bring some of the people who are listening into the conversation. We have someone here where we are, Champaign County. We'll start us off, line number one. Hello.
Hi. When you talk about corruption, I think it's admirable that you feel uncomfortable quoting Wolfowitz, because it's his colleague, Cheney, when he was head of Halliburton. There's still a process in France, a legal case about massive bribery going on. Money just doesn't disappear. It gets invested somewhere, and there are some people that say those deals, it's used to buy arms, too, that are unnecessary in a lot of ways for the government. So it's a way of keeping the money in circulation here instead of spending it on development. But this case doesn't get much press here. It's pretty notorious in Europe that Halliburton, under Cheney, when he was CEO, collaborated with a French oil company and paid a huge amount of money to, I believe it was Abacha at the time, mm-hmm. some of his minions. Mm-hmm. But so I like to, we sort of point at the corruption out there when we have, we have an amazing amount of military-industrial corruption going on here. So I just find that there's this this attitude of it's sort of, again, sort of pointing at the great unwashed, when I think we can export our democracy, we can export our mains of corruption, too. But I wanted to mention also, you can go back to the mid-90s, and you mentioned the role of the foreign corporations and some of them are American. There's an award-winning documentary from Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman called Drilling and Killing, mm-hmm. Chevron in Nigeria. And what it does, this is done in the 90s, it just goes through and looks at the evidence that Chevron was actually helping arm the people that were coming down on the Ogoni. This was before there was much of a developed resistance, but anybody that was saying, don't flare your mm-hmm. your burn off here, we're getting sick, we're dying. I've seen some pictures of the place, and mm-hmm. some areas look like moonscapes. Mm-hmm. And in the broader picture, we now have the U.S. Having a central command for Africa. We had this uncommented on Trans-Sahel strategic initiative mm-hmm. Is now, was supposed to take care of this region. It's all cashed in the terms of anti-terrorism, of course. Mm-hmm. But it actually, if you look at it, it looks at the grand area strategy, looking at the places where we're going to rely more and more for oil. And now we have the central command that actually is going to be taking over this this initiative from the military. So I laid out a lot there, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of things that people can Google if they want to look for it. But I appreciate your response. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I didn't catch the caller's name, but he raised a number of very important issues, and let me flag a couple of them. Firstly, the corruption issue. Of course, in talking about corruption, there's a lot of corruption to go around. Nigeria or the Nigerian elite don't have a monopoly on corruption. And to understand, in fact, where much of this oil wealth has gone, in some sense, by definition, necessitates that we include other sorts of actors. So when I talk about corruption in Nigeria, I'm certainly talking about the fact that there is some money which is simply evacuated, capital flight, it's called, from the country altogether. And we know in the military period, billions of dollars disappeared into unnamed Swiss bank accounts and so on. That's one aspect of corruption. Another is that in the revenue allocation process, the ways in which the government allocates money to states, to local governments, there is an enormous amount of malfeasance. The money never gets to actual development projects. There may be tenders for particular contracts that are never completed because they're inflated, and the purpose of the contract is to give a lot of money to a well-placed political actor. So that's another type of corruption. But, of course, as the caller mentioned, well, what about the companies? Well, some of this money, we now know, of course, is a corruption of another sort. Not only Halliburton, but we know that there have been a large number of instances in which the oil majors, in order to secure oil blocks in which they can both explore and drill, make very large payments to well-placed government officials and military in order to secure that. This is partly what the Halliburton case was about. But in some cases, they have been absolutely enormous. hundreds of millions of dollars have been paid to secure these sorts of things. So the companies themselves, and incidentally, the caller mentioned the case, I think, of the French company. There's a front-page story in the business section of the New York Times this morning about the French company Total Elf, in which the CEO of the company just spent some time inside. He was arrested in the context of a scandal in which such payments were made in Iran. So this is almost par for the course, not only in Nigeria, but indeed for many of the oil-producing regions around the world. Corporate corruption is as constitutive as the problem as indeed is political and state corruption. So I think that's an important point that we need to understand in trying to figure out what this edifice, this structure of corruption, looks like. Secondly, the caller also rightly talked about the related question, in a sense, of sort of militarization and the relationship between, for example, the companies who operate in Nigeria or other parts of the world, for that matter, and the security forces. I mean, a lot is to be said about this, but all that I'll say right now is that in Nigeria or any oil-producing state, what is so striking, if any visitor goes to an oil installation, an oil refinery, an oil platform, whatever it may be, is that it will always be surrounded by local military and security forces. Oil in these countries, because it's the backbone of the economy, oil in Nigeria accounts for 98% of exports, a half of gross domestic product, 80% of government revenue. It's a national security issue. And so it's always a type of highly militarized set of operations. This is as true in Saudi Arabia as it is in Nigeria. And in that context, then, the ways in which the companies have to operate and choose to operate is often precisely in relation with and indeed make use of such local security forces. So the caller mentioned a case that's currently being heard here in San Francisco in the Ninth Federal Circuit Court concerning the fact that Chevron, in the context of a protest around one of its oil installations, chose to hire and pay Nigerian military to deal with the issue. This is quite widespread, and the relationship between the companies and their operations and the military and security forces, whether we have a democratic government or not, is an incredibly important issue, because the two often operate hand in hand. So in exactly the same way, that corruption, as it were, links the companies with oil-producing states, in exactly the same way, then, the military issue and the security issue and violations of human rights around those questions also links the companies and the government.
And I have a couple of callers here I want to get to. They've been waiting patiently, but I do. The caller did raise another issue that I really do want to get back to, not right at this moment, but and that has to do with the United States and its military presence and planning in this region. But let's save that because I want to get on to a couple of other folks.
Okay, let's return to that later,
and we'll get back to that later. We promise. Indiana next, line number four. Hello.
Well, we can start on that subject right now.
Okay.
That was my question.
Okay, fine
I
then.
I was going to preface it as a very speculative. After I've listened to this for a few moments, this sounds like another black hole the United States is going to get into. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, go ahead.
Another black hole. Well, if I can engage in a piece of shameless self-promotion, a colleague and I, Paul Lubeck, have written about this issue, and some of your listeners may want to check out the website. It's the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and we have a paper there which addresses exactly this issue. It's entitled Convergent Interests, and it speaks exactly to the growing military presence of the United States, not only in Nigeria, but in the whole Gulf of Guinea. So let me, if I can, just say a few words about that. Obviously, one of the issues here is the extent to which, as I mentioned previously, the oil-producing regions in Nigeria are essentially now ungovernable. There are a series of militant insurgent movements. Oil production has been radically compromised. And the extent to which oil continues to flow, and that's of importance not only for the Nigerian government, oil revenues, but also, of course, for oil-consuming states like the United States, And let me just parenthetically say that, you know, since Mr. Cheney's name was raised, you'll remember in the 2001 energy report, which he oversaw and drafted, he was the person who made it perfectly clear that in the context of the tightness of global oil markets, and whilst he didn't use this language, what I would say is the complete failure of U.S. Oil acquisition strategy, which is to say it built its acquisition strategy around Venezuela, Iran, and Saudi Arabia in the post-war period. That now looks extremely rickety. In the context of those things, what Mr. Cheney said was, we have to look to other supply areas, and it's Africa. And Cheney said, and that report said, that by 2015, perhaps a quarter of all U.S. imports, that's much more than we currently import from Saudi Arabia, for example, will be coming from the Gulf of Guinea. So that area then, the Gulf of Guinea and Nigeria, because it's the largest producer in that region, now assumes a greater geostrategic significance for the United States in particular. So in the backdrop of all of that and the insurgency and the political instability in the region and the fact that a 30% of production is now compromised, then, of course, the question is, how does the oil, is the oil going to be made to continue to flow? Well, one way is, of course, is, and the Nigerian president has done this, is to militarize the region as it was militarized in the 1990s. And indeed, he's sent in what he's called a joint military task force to deal with these various types of conflicts and instabilities. And it's, of course, part and parcel of the growing insurgency now that we see in the region. But the other part of this, with your speaker, raised, of course, the black hole, as he put it, is, of course, that the United States also has some, in the name of energy security, has military interests in the region. And there are two, and I will just flag them for you. One, of course, is the provision of various types of military training and other sorts of facilities in the oil-producing regions. And there have been a series of initiatives over the last 3 or 4 years. State Department and the Pentagon studiously denies that there are Marines or special ops on the ground in Niger Delta, but there's no question that the area is being patrolled by the U.S. Navy, and there have been a series of new initiatives, the Gulf of Guinea Energy Security Initiative, which are in the business of trying to enhance the capacity to sort of regulate that political instability, and to set up, in fact, in the context of, as the speaker mentioned, AFRICOM, the establishment of a new African command that was just released a couple of weeks ago, a naval base in the region. So, in our paper that Paul Lubick and I wrote, we flagged this as being an issue of enormous significance, the mission creep, the growing militarization of a strategic area. But the second aspect, of course, which is something I haven't mentioned at all, is the global war on terror. Nigeria is a majority Muslim state. And in the north of the country in particular, which borders onto the Sahara, is precisely seen as part of the global war on terror, as the Pentagon puts it, a huge ungoverned area. And as part of the global war on terror, they have established a pan-Sahel anti... The Sahel is the... is the southern Saharan region, which includes part of northern Nigeria. They have included, as part of the global war on terror, this Pan-Sahel anti-terrorist initiative. And this is aimed precisely at what they see as the new locus, the new frontier of Islamism and terrorism, which is now extends from Somalia through to Senegal. So what I'm just painting, and we begin to have military forces on the ground. There have been a number of actions by the U.S. military in Chad, in Algeria. And so what we have here then, in the name of the black hole, is what is in Nigeria perceived as a pincher movement by the United States forces. From the south, the militarization of the oil-producing region in the Gulf of Guinea, and from the north, in the name of the global war on terror, is in fact pressure on the Muslim community. And in the Nigerian press in the last few months, this has produced an enormous amount of speculation about how, in fact, to draw a parallel with Iraq, that, you know, oil and energy interests are now producing a growing military and security security interests in Nigeria, working perhaps in some way with the Nigerian government, and how potentially, of course, and this is the point of the paper that Paul Lubeck and I wrote, of how politically destabilizing that's going to be if this is perceived, perhaps rightly, in Nigeria as another type of invasive set of interventions to secure cheap oil on the part of the U.S. military.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit more than that. I just very quickly want to introduce again our guest, Michael Watts. He's professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley, has been following politics in Nigeria for some time. If indeed you would like to read the paper that he has mentioned here in response to the last caller, and you do have access to the internet, very easy to go to the website of the Center for International Policy. It's in Washington. You just put that in your browser, put in Center for International Policy, you'll find it, and it would be very easy for you to take a look at either an executive summary of this particular paper, or I think you can read the whole thing.
That's correct, you can.
Without any difficulty. And questions, again, welcome here. We're getting short on time, so people will help us by being brief, but certainly callers are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we have someone who is listening up in Crystal Lake, line one.
I think you could sum it up and say that it's whenever foreign corporations like Chevron or Shell Oil go to a country, and say in Nigeria or the Sudan or Chad or Iraq or Iran, it's always the natural resources like oil in those places and some places. Our corporations go overseas to get the cheapest labor they can get, whether it's South America or Latin America. And it's globalization that protects corporations. It doesn't help the people in this country. It leads to pollution. A Nigerian protested as an environment polluting with the oil company producing and wrecking the rivers. And they hung him. It was supposedly the government, but really I'm sure it's the oil companies that supply these, that put up these governments, fake governments, phony, not representing the local people, only corporations. And the super profits, like, well, the one speaker mentioned Halliburton getting money from where RIT goes. And so we ourselves end up with pollution here with using too much oil. But we've sent fleets into the Persian Gulf to protect oil whenever we want to, and probably more often even. And instability in the regions causing insurgencies is because of our military protecting globally protecting corporations to go overseas.
Let's get a comment from the listener, from the guest, because I think that certainly the caller raises a number of questions, and it gets back to this trying to answer the question: who is really responsible for what's gone on in Nigeria, for the fact that most people have not benefited, for the fact that we do have a serious pollution problem in the Niger Delta, for the fact that there is this, already we've seen political instability and there's potential for more. I think that a lot of people would like to blame the oil companies, and certainly they should have a share of the blame. Mm-hmm. I think that you have said that some of the blame, certain share of the blame, has to indeed go on the government or a series of governments of the country where it's the money has gone in, a lot of money has gone into the central treasury of the country and then into the hands of a very few people. How does one parcel out the degree of responsibility for the situation that we have now among the various parties, multinational corporations, the government of Nigeria, perhaps this or past governments of the United States, where we also had our agendas? How do you go about doing that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the caller mentioned the name of Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was the great activist of the 1990s, who was hung by the Nigerian military in 1995, precisely because he tried to raise these issues of social and environmental justice as the leader of a particularly small ethnic group, the Ogoni, in the oil-producing region. And I refer to him simply because that he never simply pointed at the oil companies, as grotesque as their operations may be. He always referred to what he called the slick alliance between the companies and government. And he did that rightly and properly, in my view, because, of course, we don't want to let the corporations off the hook. They have enormous power, and they will get away with anything that they can. This is the history of oil operations. If getting away means not compensating communities for environmental despoliation, they'll do it. If getting away with it means using incredibly corrupt and violent local military to quell unrest, they'll get away with it. And she's absolutely right, the caller, that right now natural resources, in a sense, represents a primary focus of corporate interest in Africa. I've referred to Africa right now as being in the midst of another scramble for Africa. So something like two-thirds, perhaps even three-quarters, of all foreign investment in Africa right now is in the oil sector, scrambling for oil. And they'll get it whatever way they can. So your core is absolutely right at that level. But it seems to me to be, frankly, quite wrong to stop there and to not, in fact, see and understand the culpability of, let's say, the Nigerian political leadership and the political system. I gave you those run-through of numbers. As much as I might feel that Chevron or ExxonMobil have a grim corporate record in Nigeria, it would be nonsense to see all of that catastrophic developmental failure in Nigeria as a consequence of the companies. It's very much about a failed political system. And it seems to me, in that sense, there has to be as much culpability, in some respects perhaps even more, on the Nigerian political side. Mm. And so it seems to me the Slick Alliance looks at those two things operating in a type of perfect storm, as it were, of failed development and of sort of corporate malfeasance. This is what I've called an oil complex. It's the way in which these corporations, governments, foreign governments operate along with institutions like the World Bank and financial institutions in this sort of perfect storm of failed development. So I think the question is an important one, and I think we have to begin to look at the ways in which then we can, in some sense, make this Slick Alliance less, more transparent, more accountable. And this is where I think one way of doing that is not only ensuring that these elections that are coming up in April in Nigeria are fair, free, and open, and we have a democratic election which produces, hopefully, a new type of leadership, but also the pressures that can be exerted from the U.S. or European governments in order to prise apart this very corrupt Slick Alliance between companies and governments.
Well, it seems that even if we do have free and fair elections and we have a national government, a central government that has the kind of integrity that we would like, and it sounds as if, from based on some of your earlier comments, that we still have a problem that comes from all of from people out scattered out in the country, regional governors, people on the local level, the people who probably year after year saw all that money going into the hands of the few in the central government, and finally one day they said, "Well, we've had enough of this. We want some of this."
You bet.
Understandably so. That we now have a lot more players to worry about. The situation gets much more complex, and then of course we add on to that the fact that we have an armed insurgency going,
right.
And that's based in the area where the oil resource is
right.
concentrated. We have an extremely complicated kind of situation, even to understand, much less to, if you were going to ask this question, well, how is anybody going to intervene?
Absolutely. Like, you're exactly right. If the question is what's going to break open this incredibly venal, corrupt system, you know, it's going to be something that can't happen tomorrow or won't happen immediately just because of a successful election in April. A certain type of institutionalized culture of corruption now runs very deep down to the local level, the decentralization of corruption, as I talked about it. And that's really about a type of politics which says doing politics is the process by which you get access, you as an individual, as a politician, as a military person, as a local community, you get access to the oil revenues. That's really what politics has become, and it's produced this extraordinarily corrupt and decrepit and rank system, frankly. So that's obviously runs very deep and has to be broken and cannot be done overnight. You're absolutely right. But it seems to me the only way, or one of the ways in which that can happen within Nigeria, we can obviously exert pressures on companies to be more transparent and accountable and so on, is that civil society begins to exercise its powers and to begin to democratize the political system. So that's clear. But the second, in a sense, even more perhaps depressing and intractable problem is that these insurgents that we've talked about, of which there are a number, got to be well armed and financed largely, or in part at least, by oil theft, by the organized stealing of large quantities of oil. Perhaps, a couple of years ago anyway, it was perhaps 10 to 15% of all Nigerian oil was stolen through highly organized syndicates in which some local communities were essentially the mules, the traffickers of this oil. They got their money, they invested in arms, and they became highly militant and militarized. The problem here is simply that now the nature of these resentments are so deep, and after 40 years of failed development and marginalization, what these insurgencies are indicative of are a whole generation who are extremely bitter, rageful, and angry. And likewise, that isn't going to go away, either with a successful election. It's going to need some concrete interventions very quickly in the wake of the elections, in which many of these pent-up demands are going to have to be diffused. And in my view, that diffusion is only going to happen through investments of various sorts that generate widespread and deep employment for this whole class of individuals, young men in particular, who are currently not only unemployed, but are extremely cynical about the nature and prospects of Nigerian development.
Well, we're down to the point here. We just have about 2 minutes. What do you think the prospects are for, if we just ask the question, the prospects for having the election, having it held on time, having it be free and fair, for simply getting a good result out of the election?
Well, that's the $60,000 question, isn't it? I mean, what we can say is this, that in 2003, the elections, particularly in the oil-producing delta, were perhaps the most corrupt and were essentially rigged, lock, stock, and barrel. The record is absolutely clear on that. The question is then, in a sense, what has changed or what's likely to produce a rather different outcome right now? And frankly, I think not much. The process by the Independent Electoral Commission has been slow in terms of registering voters. Many of the safeguards that one would expect to be in place are not in place. And the type of pre-election and during-election ballot rigging that we saw in 2003, which were extensive and widespread in the Niger Delta, I think are entirely possible in these upcoming elections. It's unfortunate that, for example, the European Union just in the last week decided that it won't be sending its election monitors to the Niger Delta precisely because of security problems. And so if, in fact, there aren't, at the very minimum, monitors available and dispersed throughout the delta, we're not even going to know too much about the nature of the potential rigging or fraud that's involved. But I guess I can't say that I'm optimistic about, in some areas at least, it may be different in other parts of Nigeria, of the extent to which these elections, which I think will go forward, I don't think there will be anything catastrophic that will happen to prevent them going forward. But the actual process itself, I can't be terribly optimistic about. Mm.
Well, there are apparently several potential candidates. Among them, the candidate that has the candidate essentially of the current ruling party, the People's Democratic Party, who has received the imprimatur of President Obasanjo.
Yep.
Do you think that is he? Do you think the likely winner, or would there be somebody else?
If I were a gambling man, which I'm not, I'd put my money on the PDP, which is this interesting alliance between the northern Muslim political machine, the presidential candidate is named Yar Adua, and actually the oil-producing region, the governor of one of the oil-producing states, Goodluck Jonathan. And so that's an interesting alliance in and of itself, that the Niger Delta has now emerged as being so politically significant that the most powerful political party has to cut a deal in order to ensure, in some sense, or guarantee some type of victory. I think they will, in fact, win, but there's been a lot of speculation in the Nigerian press about how both of these characters, the vice presidential candidate and the presidential candidate, are both relatively weak politically, not charismatic, not terribly strong, And there's been some speculation that this has all been engineered by Obasanjo himself to ensure a type of outcome in which he, if you bear in mind, he wanted to run for a third term and was defeated by the Senate, who refused to go along with it last summer, that this is a way of Obasanjo then, in some sense, installing a couple of weak leaders, which may have some political viability because of their regional connection, but nonetheless is ultimately under his control. This is a sort of cynical interpretation of what's going on, but I think in general I would say that that North-South alliance linking the oil region with the heart of the sort of Muslim North is a likely winner at the presidential level.
Well, there we'll have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest, Michael Watts. He's professor of geography, University of California, Berkeley. Professor Watts, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.